Today is Friday, September 21st, 2018, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Bertel in Washington. Coming up, more than 100 people are dead after a passenger ferry capsizes on Lake Victoria.
The problem, of course, is that Kim Jong-un, at this stage, hasn't done a single meaningful thing to dismantle his nuclear weapons.
Will there be tangible progress after the Korean summit? And we'll take a look at the Trump administration's new cybersecurity strategy. It's all on today's International Edition. Tragedy in Tanzania. More than 100 people are dead after a ferry overturned in Tanzania's part of Lake Victoria. Reuters' Anna Bevan reports.
The wreckage of an overturned ferry that sank in Tanzania's part of Lake Victoria Thursday, killing dozens of people. But government officials fear the final death toll could reach as high as 200. Initial estimates show there were more than 300 people on board. The local district commissioner took part in the immediate rescue effort.
We are here to do a rescue so that if there are any alive, with God's help, we rescue them. As for those who have died, we'll get them out too. For now, we are concentrating on the rescue operation, though. As you can see, specialists have arrived.
The ferry sank just meters from the dock on Lake Victoria's biggest island.
That was Reuters' Anna Bevan reporting. This week's inter-Korean summit delivered many positive pledges by North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, including the dismantling of key missile facilities and closing its main nuclear complex if Washington took reciprocal actions. U.S. President Donald Trump and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo praised the offer. But the details still need to be worked out. Bruce Bennett, senior defense analyst at the RAND Corporation, told VOA's Victor Beatty, shutting down the Yongbyon nuclear reactor will likely take longer than other aspects of the North's denuclearization.
To collect up all of North Korea's nuclear weapons and disable his production capabilities, you could do that in a year or so, I would expect. The problem, of course, is that Kim Jong-un, at this stage, hasn't done a single meaningful thing to dismantle his nuclear weapons. In fact, he's going the opposite direction. He's making nuclear weapons and increasing his stockpile. And there's really nothing in the summit that's going to stop him from doing that. I think President Moon likely tried as hard as he could, but I don't think Kim Jong-un has decided yet that he really is going to do this. I think he's playing for time.
So you see no significance in the pronouncement of a dismantling of key missile facilities in the eyes of so-called concerned country experts or the closure of the main Yongbyon nuclear complex?
The missile facilities, Kim Jong-un had already talked about dismantling those. This wasn't something new. This was a repeat of something that had already occurred. On the Yongbyon complex, he says, well, I'm prepared to do this if I'm compensated by the Americans. Excuse me? He's already been generously compensated for doing something which he hasn't really done yet. This is a kind of case where, like I say, for many Americans, I think he seems to be stalling. I think he's anxious to build up his nuclear weapons to the point where he can actively coerce the United States and other regional countries. But he's not there yet, and so he's got to delay us taking serious action against him.
Is the U.S. reacting too quickly to this summit?
Oh, no. I think regardless of whether we think that Kim Jong-un is prepared to do what he is obligated and committed to doing, we still ought to try our best to get him to meet his commitments. I mean, he is committed. The April 27th agreement, Kim said he would implement all previous agreements, and one of the previous agreements said he would go to zero nuclear weapons. So Kim is committed to going to zero. He's just going in the opposite direction, and that's really hard to understand if he's sincere.
He's calling for U.S. unspecified actions in return. What might those include?
Oh, I think what he wants is relaxation of the sanctions. That's clear that he wants that. I think he wants diplomatic recognition, but probably most important is a peace agreement. He wants a peace agreement, I believe, because he wants to undermine the basis for U.S. troops in Korea. You know, he knows he could do that bilaterally with President Moon of South Korea tomorrow. President Moon would sign a peace agreement with him, but that doesn't get him what he wants. What he wants is the U.S. to sign a peace agreement so that then China and Russia can go to the U.N. and say, see, the U.S. signed a peace agreement. There's no longer a need for a U.N. command in Korea. All of the U.S. forces that are in Korea don't need to be there because there's peace now.
Bruce Bennett said he believes part of the North's strategy is to drive a wedge between allies South Korea and the U.S. Among the top stories in the world today, Vietnamese President Tran Đại Quang died Friday after a serious illness. He was 61. China is calling on the United States to withdraw sanctions it imposed on a Chinese military agency for buying Russian weapons in violation of U.S. sanctions on Russia. An international human rights watchdog group is accusing Nicolas Maduro's government of committing some of the worst human rights violations in Venezuela's history. A group of conservative lawmakers in Ecuador is calling for WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange's Ecuadorian nationality to be revoked, citing irregularities in the process to make him a citizen. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
Homo erectus is a primitive hominid species that is said to have lived between about 2 million and 143,000 years ago. This early human relative is said to be the first hominid species to migrate from Africa. But like other archaic human relatives, Homo erectus became extinct. A team of scientists led by the Australian National University say they found evidence that one reason why this species came to an end was because, in essence, they were lazy. The scientists who studied material found in archaeological excavations that date back to the early Stone Age say they found indications that Homo erectus really didn't put that much effort into their tool-making and how they collected resources. They say that these archaic people seemingly looked for the easiest way to do things that were key to their survival. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Thank you for joining us today. President Donald Trump will join other world leaders Monday at the United Nations for their annual meetings. From wars to climate change to hunger and disease, there's no shortage of issues on the agenda. VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir takes a look at what to expect.
President Trump made quite a debut at last year's General Assembly.
The United States has great strength and patience. But if it is forced to defend itself or its allies, we will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea. Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself and for his regime.
He stunned leaders used to nuanced diplomacy, and many are wondering what he will do for an encore. Richard Gowan is with the UN University Center for Policy Research.
That was great television. It played incredibly well on U.S. networks. Trump is not really here to charm other leaders. He is here to make some headlines with some powerful statements just before the U.S. midterm elections. So there will be fire and there will be fury.
While his approach was unconventional and not without risk, it did lead to dialogue. Many will be watching to gauge Trump's tone on North Korea during his Tuesday morning address to the Assembly. Leader Kim Jong-un will not be in the audience, but will likely be watching closely from Pyongyang. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has also invited his North Korean counterpart to meet with him in New York. On Thursday, Pompeo will chair a meeting of the UN Security Council. He will brief on how discussions with North Korea are going and urge countries to keep up the sanctions pressure until Pyongyang takes concrete steps to denuclearize. The U.S. holds the rotating presidency of the Security Council, and President Trump will chair a meeting Wednesday to focus on nonproliferation. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley says he will talk a lot about Iran.
Iran continues to be a problem. Every dangerous spot in the world, Iran seems to have its fingerprints in it.
Iran's president will address the General Assembly on Tuesday and hold a news conference just hours after Trump's Security Council session on Wednesday. Hassan Rouhani is likely to criticize the U.S. for withdrawing from the 2015 Iran nuclear deal and its decision to reimpose unilateral sanctions on Tehran. While many leaders will be present in New York, there will be some notable exceptions. Russian President Vladimir Putin and Chinese President Xi Jinping are skipping the gathering. German Chancellor Angela Merkel will also be a no-show. And while North Korea and Iran may dominate the headlines, there will be work on many pressing global issues, including conflicts in the Middle East and Africa, global warming and development. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
The UN Children's Fund warns thousands of refugee and migrant children are living in dire and dangerous conditions in overcrowded facilities on the Greek islands. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The UN Children's Fund reports more than 7,000 refugee and migrant children are living under horrible, unsanitary conditions on the Greek islands. On average, it says more than 850 children make the dangerous sea journey to Greece every month, only to end up in facilities that are congested and lacking all basic necessities. UNICEF's country coordinator in Greece, Lucio Melandri, says he was appalled by what he saw on a recent visit to centers on the islands of Lesbos and Samos. While there, he says he met refugee children from Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and the Democratic Republic of Congo.
The vast majority of the children are deeply traumatized. Many have lived through war and have had to flee their homes. They have survived, but now find themselves living in horrible condition with no end in sight. For many children, they simply cannot cope.
Melandri says housing on the islands are totally unacceptable. For example, he notes the Moria Center on the island of Lesbos hosts nearly 9,000 people in a facility meant for 3,000. He says the center on Samos, built for 650 people, houses 4,000. He says staff is overwhelmed and warned services in these centers could collapse in the coming winter months. UNICEF says all refugees and migrants living in the centers, especially children, must be transferred to the mainland without further delay. It says these vulnerable people must be given adequate accommodation, protection, health care, and other basic services. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is VOA's International Edition. The U.S. Senate is moving toward a final showdown over the nomination of Judge Brett Kavanaugh for the Supreme Court. Kavanaugh's nomination was thrown into turmoil after Christine Blasey Ford accused him of sexual assault when they were both teenagers. Kavanaugh has denied the allegation. This latest Supreme Court confirmation battle records another high-stakes drama that riveted the country back in 1991, as we hear from VOA national correspondent Jim Malone.
It would have been more
nearly 27 years ago, law professor Anita Hill was front and center in the national spotlight.
To report my experience, I felt that I had to tell the truth.
Hill told the Senate Judiciary Committee that she was the victim of sexual harassment by Clarence Thomas, a nominee for the Supreme Court put forward by President George H.W. Bush. In an emotional hearing that transfixed the country, Thomas denied the allegations and condemned the inquiry.
As a black American, as far as I'm concerned, it is a high-tech lynching for uppity blacks who in any way deign to think for themselves.
Thomas narrowly won confirmation to the high court, but many women felt that Hill had been treated harshly by the all-male Senate committee. Nearly three decades later, echoes of the Anita Hill-Clarence Thomas showdown still resonate in the Me Too movement, where numerous women have come forward to call out the behavior of many powerful men. Legal analyst Paul Schiff Berman.
I think we can trace that movement in many ways to the anger that came out of the Anita Hill-Clarence Thomas hearings during Clarence Thomas's confirmation process.
Based on her experience of many years ago, Hill has urged the Senate to fully investigate Christine Blasey Ford's allegations against Judge Kavanaugh.
We are talking about an appointment for a lifetime on this nation's highest court, making decisions that are going to affect Americans probably for decades.
The Hill-Thomas showdown also has a special meaning for Democratic Senator Patty Murray.
I am a United States Senator today because of the way Anita Hill was treated in 1991. Women are watching. We are not going to allow that to happen again.
Republicans want to hear from both Ford and Kavanaugh about the alleged assault, but they also sense a political ploy by Democrats, says Senator Mitch McConnell.
Ranking member of the Judiciary Committee had notice of this for quite some time and decided to spring it right at the end. And it's pretty obvious this is all about delaying the process.
To many, the battle over Kavanaugh is the latest chapter of how polarized politics is paralyzing Washington. Conservative analyst Jamil Jaffer.
And it's unfortunate as a country because the Supreme Court, if handled properly, should be immune from these things. We should be confirming people who are qualified, you know, in the 90s, and we should be letting them do their job, which is not to set policy, but instead to say what the law is.
And so as a divided Senate prepares to render a judgment on Brett Kavanaugh, many Americans recall that they have seen this drama play out before. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. Here's a quick quiz. What do the letters LTATONLAW stand for? We know the answer, right? Listen to Akwe Thompson on Nightline Africa Weekends. Add to that 16 and 18 UTC on VOA, and we have a perfect score. That was easy.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on the Voice of America.
And welcome back to VOA's International Edition. President Trump signed a new national cyber strategy on Thursday. Joining me is VOA's national security correspondent, Jeff Seldon. Jeff, how does this differ from past strategies?
Well, a lot of people are praising the strategy because it's a more aggressive policy. It's a more aggressive strategy than what they saw under the Obama administration. National Security Advisor John Bolton, while briefing reporters on Thursday, said this is going to be an aggressive policy. This is going to be an aggressive strategy. The U.S. is going to take measures when necessary in cyberspace, and it will go on the offensive. And so the message the administration is sending is that if you're an adversary of the United States and if you decide to conduct some sort of cyber attack, whether it's a hacking attack, phishing attack, intruding into and getting into U.S. networks, or even possibly a disinformation campaign like what was seen with the 2016 elections, the U.S. will strike back, may very well strike back in cyberspace, and there will be a cost that you will accrue for attacking the U.S. You're not going to get away with it scot-free. The question is going to be, how does that aggressive language play out in terms of strategy, and then how do U.S. adversaries... And they name Russia, they name Iran, North Korea, they name China. How do these types of U.S. adversaries then respond to this new national cyber strategy? One of the criticisms of the strategy as it is right now is while it articulates better what the U.S. wants to do, at least the declassified version doesn't have a lot of detail, and there are questions, and the U.S. Government Accountability Office in recent weeks has raised questions saying that while a lot of the measures that have been put in place by the Trump administration thus far are good, they're still not seeing a cohesive, coherent strategy to bring all aspects of the government together.
Is there a defensive aspect to this new strategy?
For a long time, the U.S. had concentrated on defensive actions in cyberspace, hardening networks, trying to do things better to protect government data, consumer data. That remains as part of the new cyber strategy. The new twist, though, is that the U.S. is going to be more aggressive online. And National Security Advisor John Bolton hinted at it. Defense officials have also talked about it, that cyber actions are underway. The commander of U.S. Cyber Command spoke a few weeks ago and talked about something what he called persistent engagement. That is, instead of just trying to harden systems and figure out what areas to protect against a cyber attack, going out there and constantly being engaged with the adversaries online, whether it's a nation state like Russia or China, or whether it's a terrorist group like Islamic State, and constantly being engaged with them, fighting them, feeling them out, and when appropriate, launching cyber attacks in return.
VOA's national security correspondent, Jeff Selden, thanks very much.
Anytime.
Communities along the U.S. southeast coast are drying out after Hurricane Florence. The storm poured more than 80 centimeters of rain in some areas, causing catastrophic flooding. Hurricanes are categorized by their wind speeds, but that's not always what does the most damage. Some experts say we should reconsider the scale. VOA's Steve Barragona has more.
By the time Florence hit the North Carolina coast, it had weakened from a Category 4 hurricane to a Category 1. Resident Famous Roberts decided not to evacuate.
A lot of people didn't think it was actually going to be as bad as it did, but with the category drop, yes, that's another factor why we did stay.
Wind speeds determine a hurricane's category, and Florence's had dropped to a relatively tame 140 kilometers per hour. At the top of the scale, Category 5 starts at 250 kilometers per hour. But soakers like Florence have some meteorologists reconsidering that scale, like the University of Georgia's Marshall Shepard.
There's a significant danger in focusing too much on category with storms like Hurricane Florence or Harvey. The impacts of those storms are much broader than wind speed, but yet that's what the categories in the Saffir-Simpson scale give us.
The most damaging part of Florence was not the wind, it was the rain, more than 80 centimeters in some places. And last year, Hurricane Harvey poured more than 120 centimeters of water over parts of Texas.
Neither of these storms were really above Category 1 when they did their most damage. Of course, Harvey was a Cat 4 at landfall, but most of that rain fell in Houston when it was a tropical storm.
Forecasters warned about catastrophic flooding as Florence approached the coast, but experts say the message might not have resonated the way a simple five-point scale does. Famous Roberts says he'll pay closer attention when the next storm hits.
Because you never know. I mean, when they tell you things, you listen, you know. Next time, it could be worse.
Some scientists are working on alternative ways to convey the potential threats that storms carry. But for now, they say, categories 1 through 5 are the best they've got. Steve Barragona, VOA News.
And you've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. And you can like us on Facebook at VOA Now. I want to thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Patrice Martin, engineer Nick Ivanoff. I'm Jim Bertel in Washington. Thanks for listening.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA. every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.